with all charges resolved. Kevin didn't go back to jail. What I've learned the more time I've spent following Jesus is that God delights in answering our impossible prayers, the kind of prayers made in a dark cell by someone holding unwashed hands, prayers asking for things we couldn't possibly think could happen for us or someone else, ones we might even feel a little bad saying, as if it's just asking God for too much. But what I forget is that we're talking to a God who knows what we need the most is to return to Him, to return to our lives. And like the judge, God knows that we can't fully return until we know we've been forgiven. God pursues us into whatever dark place we've landed and behind whatever locked door holds us in. He holds our unwashed and dirty hands and models how He wants us to pursue each other. Sometimes that means picking up a phone and asking a stranger to do something that seems crazy at first. He invites us to leave perfectly fine careers like Charlie did, and rather than having us apply for a position, He says our lives are the position. And He says to ordinary people like me and you that instead of closing our eyes and bowing our heads, sometimes God wants us to keep our eyes open for the people in need, to do something about it, and to bow our whole lives to Him instead. We found another set of jail cells in a different region of Uganda, and another after that, and another after that. More kids had their hands held in dark cells by strangers, and then had their forgotten cases heard by the courts. And after their trials, these kids were also dropped off at their homes to return to their lives. We found one particularly horrible jail in the bush, which had warehoused more than a dozen kids behind an old wooden door for years. These cases were heard, and when the last kid was dropped off at home after trial, I had the old wooden door ripped off the hinges. It now stands in the corner of my office. It's a reminder to me that God searches for us, no matter what dark places we're in and what door we're behind. He hears our impossible, audacious prayers for ourselves and others, and He delights in forgiving us and then answering those prayers by letting us return home to Him. It reminds me that when we take Jesus up on His promises, He doesn't just stand in our lives knocking. He rips our small view of Him and what He can make possible right off the hinges. I've been back to that last jail a couple of times, and the warden is still a little bent out of shape that I took his door. He complained to me recently that there wasn't a way to keep kids inside the building now with the door gone. Door or no, God answered an impossible and audacious prayer that each of those kids would be able to return to their life. I told the warden he didn't need the door anymore and that I'm not giving it back. Sue me. Chapter 27. The Story. I used to think I needed to record stories, but now I know I just need to engage them. My son Adam and I bought a sailboat this fall. Actually, I didn't buy it. Adam did. I just went with him when he did the deal. He'd been saving his money for a while and had just enough money for a nice rowboat, paddles optional. He told me one day he'd found an old sailboat on Craigslist that was 27 feet long and he had enough money for it. How can you get a 27-foot boat for the small bag of money you've got, I asked. I'm not sure, he said, but if he'll sell it, I want it, Adam shot back. Adam called the guy and they agreed on a time for the two of them to meet on the docks. I tagged along, like concerned dads do, knowing that you can't get a whole sailboat for a little more than the price of a nice set of golf clubs. I was going to make it a teachable moment, you know, where the dad intervenes when the guy doesn't have the pink slip, or the boat belongs to a friend who's out of the country, or part of the deal involves the guy living on the boat with his girlfriend, two dogs, and a llama. I was ready to explain to Adam that sometimes there are scams, and he needs to be on guard for that kind of thing. When we arrived, however, we found a really clean-cut guy with a big smile and a warm handshake, wearing a plaid shirt and some faded blue jeans. The boat was rough around the edges, to be sure, but he was down below tidying up and making sure that all the life jackets were in order, the lines were coiled, and the radio worked. He offered us a couple sodas when we arrived and said, "Yeah, this has been a great boat. I've really had fun with it." He started telling us all the places he'd gone with it. It wasn't a sales pitch. It was like he was flipping through the pages of a picture book in his mind, introducing us to all the really good friends of his. He told us about how he was from the Midwest, and he'd always wanted to have a sailboat. So when he arrived in San Diego a number of years ago, it was the first thing he got. He was a research scientist at Scripps Research Institute, part of the research team working on cures for malaria, HIV/AIDS, deafness, blindness, and cancer. I felt pretty awkward and self-conscious as he described what he did, because all I'd done that day is edge the lawn. This was hardly a guy I imagined selling the boat. "So why are you selling the boat?" I asked, trying to tease out any underhandedness. "I don't have any time anymore," he said. "It kills me to let her go, but it's just time to move on. What I'd love is to find someone to add to the legacy of this boat." He looked at Adam as he said this, projecting an emboldening, "Are you up for the challenge?" vibe. Adam and I both liked that he said it that way, the part about the legacy. "Is the price you listed on Craigslist a typo?" Adam blurted. He was tired of the small talk, eager to get the deal underway. "Nope, that's all I'm asking. It's a great price that will only go to the right person." Adam stuck out his arm for a handshake and confidently said, "I'll take it." The scientist paused for a moment, feigning a deep and skeptical deliberation. Then he cracked his warm smile as he reached for Adam's outstretched hand. Despite the glow of Adam's pride, we had to acknowledge that it wasn't a new boat. In fact, it was almost 40 years old. The fiberglass looked like it had been ridden hard and put away wet for several decades. You could tell the adventurous scientist bypassed frills like soap and wax and rubbing compound. Several of the fasteners that hold the sail to the mast were missing. We pulled up the sails, which I'm sure were once bright, white, crisp, and had the feel of white starched tin. Now, however, they hung limp like so many bedsheets from the top of the mast. The two spinnakers on board should have been labeled bad and worse. They would have made better rust-stained dropcloths than sails. The teak rails looked like pieces of driftwood, with every third screw missing. The running lights didn't work. We started the engine and it coughed like it had been chain-smoking oil for years. Down below, the smell of mold, must, and old gasoline was overwhelming. Through that bouquet, I could detect a hint of urine as well. None of this mattered to Adam. What was important is that this was now his sailboat. We had to get the boat down the coast to a dock we had behind our house. Adam had never been out in the ocean with a sailboat, which could have been a minor issue. We had a choice. We could either plan the trip or just do the trip. We didn't even talk about the option. We raised the sails, spun the winches like we thought we should, and started sailing. Anything else we figured we'd learn along the way. The trip was uneventful, and a number of hours later we were rounding Point Loma and into the calm waters of the San Diego Bay. If nothing else, the boat was brimming with whimsy. Whimsy was the gleam in our eyes. Whimsy swelled the sails. Whimsy swelled our hearts. That's the way whimsy works. It's a renewable, infinite source that multiplies. I've come to understand more about faith as I've understood more about whimsy. What whimsy means to me is a combination of the do part of faith along with doing something worth doing. It's whimsy that spreads hope like grass seed in the wind. Whimsy reminds me of the Bible too, when it talks about stuff being like an aroma. It's not an overpowering one, just something that has a scent of God's love, an unmistakable scent that lingers. Back at the dock, I asked Adam if he'd thought about a name for his boat. We spend the summers up in Canada and invite people to come and stay for a while, to have conversations about how life makes sense to them. Adam's usually off on the side serving, fixing an engine, or riding a motorcycle. He's one of those guys who don't steal the spotlight. The summer had been filled with discussions about the story we're telling with our lives, and that we could be living a better story. My friend Don told him that. Turns out that these conversations had left a wonderful watermark in Adam's life. When I asked Adam what he wanted to name his boat, he sat back in his chair for a long minute, looking up and to the left. He fiddled with his jeans some and then said, "I want to name her The Story." I realized that Adam saw this tattered sailboat completely different than most other people would. Most would see an old jalopy of a sailboat, better sunk than sailed. For Adam, though, The Story wouldn't be a sailing machine, it would be a story machine. To him, it was filled with whimsy, wonder, and adventure, even before he untied it from the dock. Adam knows that I'm working on a project, and I've been working on it for years. It's to write down everything I can remember from my entire life. The first bee sting, the first time I touched knees with someone I liked, the first time I flunked out of a course or got a speeding ticket. I don't keep a journal or a diary, and I'll never just write down facts, like what I had for lunch or who I was with or where I was. Instead, what I've been writing down are all the things I can remember that have shaped me, all of the words or phrases that have pinged me, all of the stories that have happened in my life, all in the hopes that one day, as I flip through the pages, I'll see evidence of Jesus in them. When Adam told me he wanted to name his boat, The Story, I wondered out loud with him if he had ever thought about writing down all of his memories as well. What Adam said surprised me again. He thought about it for a second or two and said, "Well, you know, Dad, I've thought about that too. Nothing personal, but I realize that right now I'm doing the things other people seem to think of as memories someday. It seems like memories are what older people think of when they think back about being my age, when they could actually do something about them. So I think what I'll do instead of writing things down now is just do lots of things, and then maybe when I'm done doing cool things, I can write them down later." I always learn a lot from Adam. I want a boat or a motorcycle or a hot air balloon named The Story too. I think we should all get back to building that rocket ship we dreamed of when we thought about what our life would be about. I want to be doing things today, not just flipping through crinkled and yellowed mental pictures of what happened a long time ago. I need my own vehicle to get there, though. We all do. That vehicle will look a little different for everyone. One boat size, one story size doesn't fit all. We each need to get into something of our own each day, something that will take us to a new place, a place that needs us. Perhaps I'll name my boat Whimsy and try to untie it from the dock of my mind at least once a day and take it for a lap. Maybe you will too. If Adam is right about memories being reserved for folks who don't do anything cool anymore, then I don't want to just collect memories anymore. I've been thinking I'll follow Love's lead and find some capers worth doing, ones so saturated with whimsy that they have to be wrung out like a wet towel to be fully understood. I think I'll have a dinghy that I tie to the back of my imaginary boat. I was toying with naming it The End, but I think I'll name it Get In instead, because I used to think I needed to record stories, but now I think I just need to engage them. Chapter 28. Skin in the Game. I used to think I needed to pick sides, but now I know it's better to pick a fight. I picked a fight with a guy named Dale in the 7th grade. He was huge. He almost blocked the sun when he walked by. I didn't like Dale because he was a bully and beat up the little guys. I'm not sure why he didn't like me. I didn't have good looks or a flock of ladies wanting to be my girlfriends. I suppose if acne fomented anger, back then I had enough to start a war. Maybe Dale didn't like me because I wasn't a little guy and I wasn't going to let him push me or anyone else around. Who knows what bullies think, or if they even think. Bullies are people who use conflict as a means for obtaining power. Some young people grow out of this, others don't and become old bullies. It was pretty easy to pick a fight with Dale. I told him one day when he was beating up another kid that I was going to let him keep doing it. Seriously, in the middle of the romping, I stepped forward from the small crowd that had gathered and said, "Dale, I'm calling you out." That's junior high speak for "let's have a fist fight." He spun around slowly with an evil grin on his face, the kind that hungry giants make in the storybooks. He was delighted to have his next victim step forward so willingly. Like we were finalizing some business transaction, we picked the date and the time for the fight. A few days later, we went to the cul-de-sac by the school where they were building track homes. A large throng of kids following. There weren't many fistfights in my school, and this was long before talk shows turned violent, so this was big news. Almost equal to the yearbooks arriving or a snow day, which in California was a big deal. We started our fight with a lot of pushing and shoving and tough talk. Then we slugged each other for a while and traded headlocks. By the time a teacher came over to break it up, Dale was covered in blood. Nobody realized all of it was mine, so I declared myself the winner and we both got expelled for a couple of days. Here's an important thing to note. If you're gonna schedule a fight with a bully and risk getting expelled from elementary school, always pick a fight on a Thursday. That way you get a long weekend out of the deal. My parents weren't too thrilled by the whole ordeal. Actually, Mom shook her head and she said she was very disappointed with me. Dad pretended to reinforce her scolding while winking and giving me high fives behind her back. Now that I'm an adult, I totally get this, by the way. Once I explain my just cause, fighting for the helpless, I talked myself out of being grounded for the weekend, and by Monday, Dale and I were back at school, exchanging gunslinger stares as we passed each other in the hallways. I was ready to move on. I had lost enough blood. I guess for people who slug people, guys like Dale and maybe some folks you know, they rarely, if ever, get anything resolved. It's not about resolution for them, it's about fighting. That fight with Dale, looking back on it, shows me something about my own hardwiring. I got into and graduated from law school, idealistic and ready to help people resolve their disputes. I guess I'm driven by the same need to stand up for the little guy, but without using my fists. Jesus talked a lot about disputes, and I'm surprised he never said not to have them. I suppose that's because he knew disputes would somehow be inevitable. What Jesus commented on, though, is a small list of things worth having a fight about. Jesus also talked about how to resolve disputes. He had been in the center of quite a few of them, so he would know. He's still been the subject of countless disputes since he was killed. Even death and resurrection don't solve some things, I guess. While I didn't think I could resolve disputes as well as Jesus, I figured that I could learn from what he had said about them. I like the part where he said that his followers should just find a person with the least credentials to decide the biggest disputes among them. It sounded crazy to me at first, because I'd want to find the smartest person, or the most important person, or the most powerful person to resolve a dispute for me. Jesus thought, however, that the least would bring the most to the table. He said that's how his reverse economy worked. I figured it still might work that way, so I decided to give it a try. Just out of law school, I figured I had all the qualifications Jesus talked about for helping people with their fights, because I was nobody in particular, I was broke, and I didn't have any power or credentials. So I opened up what I called the Christian Mediation Service. I know, catchy name, right? Honestly, I'm a little embarrassed about it now when I look back, but my heart was in the right place as a brand new lawyer, and I wanted to use my legal education to make a difference. The first two Christians who came through the door had a dispute that, in a few minutes it was obvious, ran incredibly deep between them. A few minutes more, and I figured out that they really hated each other's guts. It wasn't ordinary hate either. It was the kind they make scary movies about. I met them over and over again, and I tried everything I could think to get them to bridge the huge fissure that divided them. Their hatred for each other came with an unparalleled passion, a hatred so vile that it took my family getting me an incontinent poodle named Riley as a pet to experience it firsthand. Through our sessions, I determined that these guys were more interested in inflicting pain on each other through the legal system than actually resolving their disputes. All the talk about resolving conflicts using concepts the Bible talked about, things like love and forgiveness and self-reflection, were just so many words to these guys. Sure, they had all the Christian phrases. On more than one occasion, I even heard them belt out scripture verses at each other like machine gun fire. What they lacked was the heart of Jesus, which is the linchpin to resolving anything. Everything else having failed, I considered inviting them to slug it out like Dale and I had, and that's exactly what I did. I rented a boxing ring, hired a referee, and got two sets of headgear and gloves. It cost me $35 I didn't have, but I was so tired of these guys and their Christianese, I'd take on the winner if they wanted. Heck, I'd take them both on. I called the two guys and gave them the date, time, and place where the boxing ring was and said I'd meet them there so we can settle things once and for all. When I first started following Jesus, I wondered what Christians did when they had disputes. Did they even have disputes anymore? I wasn't sure. After a while, though, I realized that people who love God have disputes just like everybody else. Some people acted religious about it, and they seemed to get even more religious the bigger the dispute was. The religious people also seemed to carry on their disputes remotely, and surrounded the dispute with so many 20-pound Christian words that it was hard to figure out what they were originally mad about, much less resolve anything. Lots of them had to do with what the religious people thought Christians were supposed to be for or against. What struck me as ironic is that the Bible talked about us being like dust or vapor or like other insignificant things. Yet these folks spoke like they were the ones that had made the mountains when it came to how someone else should act. It wasn't infrequent that one of the religious people would accuse the other person of backsliding. Christian speak that basically means the other person doesn't act religious enough. I always thought that was a bad choice of words, actually, because it made it sound fun, kind of like ice blocking. I get why people don't want to go hand-to-hand with the depth of kindness Jesus found common. I get why it's easier to just say what sounds like the right stuff from inside a bunker. The problem is, the Bible said the only weapon any of us really have is love. But it's love like a sword without a handle, and because of that, sometimes we'll get cut when we pick it up. It's supposed to be close contact, though. Love always is that way. I don't think Bible verses were meant to be thrown like grenades at each other. They were meant for us to use to point each other towards love and grace and invite us into something much bigger. All of us want to deal with issues from a safe distance. I know I do. But the stakes couldn't be higher with the small conflicts. If we don't get those right, when it's game day for the big disputes, we'll be still wrapped around the axle with all the previous unresolved disagreements. That's what was happening to these two guys. When the day came for the two guys to resolve things in the boxing ring, I was sitting on the edge of the canvas with my sweats and tennis shoes on. I even put a towel around my neck because I saw it on a Rocky movie once. I was looking forward to finally resolving this argument, even if it required stitches. Almost predictably, though, neither of the guys showed up, and I never heard from them again. I still spend a great deal of my professional life resolving conflicts for others. Some people talk about wanting to resolve their conflicts, but more often, they really have a secret, sometimes subconscious agenda to keep the fight going. The trick is figuring out which is really underneath. Are they all Christianese just looking to swap big Christian words like knives? Or do they want to model what Jesus said, risk being wronged, and through that, experience just how big God is? There's a character in the Bible named Joshua. Over and over, God told Joshua and his posse to be strong and courageous. God doesn't say in the Bible we're supposed to man up or dance around the fire naked or tell manly stories. Instead, we're just supposed to be strong and courageous. That's it. The way I read it, it sounds an awful lot like God is calling us out and telling us to pick a fight. As Joshua was about to enter the land God promised him, he met an angel with his sword drawn in front of him. Joshua must have had some lawyer in him, because he asked the angelic warrior something I would ask. Whose side are you on? No doubt, Joshua was hoping that the angelic warrior was for them. That's what I'd hope for. I love the warrior's answer to Joshua's question. It was simple. Neither. Take off your shoes. The angel wasn't interested in picking sides. He wanted them to pick God. The angel told them to take off their shoes because they were on holy ground, just like we are today. Perhaps God doesn't want us spending our time picking sides or teams and trying on jerseys either. He wants us to pick a fight, and he also wants us to pick him. I want to pick a fight because I want someone else's suffering to matter more to me. I want to slug it out where I can make a meaningful difference. God says he wants us to battle injustice, to look out for orphans and widows, to give sacrificially. And anyone who gets distracted with the minutiae of this point or that opinion is tagged out of the real skirmish. God wants us to get some skin in the game and to help make a tangible difference. I can't make a real need matter to me by listening to the story, visiting the website, collecting information, or wearing a bracelet about it. I need to pick a fight myself, to call it out, just like I called Dale out. Then, most important of all, I need to run barefoot towards it. But I want to go barefoot because it's holy ground. I want to be running because time is short, and none of us has as much runway as we think we do. And I want it to be a fight because that's where we can make a difference. That's what love does. Sure, it's easier to pick an opinion than it is to pick a fight. It's also easier to pick an organization or a jersey and to identify with a fight than to actually go pick one, to commit to it, to call it out and to take a swing. Picking a fight isn't neat either. It's messy, it's time-consuming, it's painful, and it's costly. It sounds an awful lot like the kind of fight Jesus took on for us when he called out death for us and won. Chapter 29. Memorizing Jesus. I used to think I could learn about Jesus by studying him, but now I know Jesus doesn't want stalkers. Have you ever been stalked? I don't think I have, but I suppose it would be hard to tell if the stalker was any good at it. Stalking is one of those creepy things that once you start talking about it, you imagine it's happening to you. More people trying to follow Jesus should think about what stalkers do, but not for the reasons you might think. I get paid as a lawyer to collect information and memorize facts, and I've gotten really good at it. What I realize about my faith is that I'm doing just that, collecting information and memorizing facts about Jesus. I collected pictures and gathered artifacts and bumper stickers about Christianity, and I talked about knowing Jesus like we were best friends when actually we really hardly knew each other at all. And I memorized Bible verses and the names of the books of the Bible in order and the sequence of a bunch of events as well as who was there. At some point, I had to confess I was stalking Jesus. I was actually creeping myself out a little bit, and I realized that I was probably creeping God out too, so I decided I'd stop. The first thing I did was quit going to what Christians call a Bible study. A Bible study sounds like a wholesome thing to go to, and honestly, they are. They can come in as many flavors as there are people leading them. At the ones I went to, I learned a bunch of facts and information about Jesus. We might be studying how a guy named Lazarus was raised from the dead by Jesus. The leader would open up a reference book and say something like, the word dead means in the Greek. Then he'd say, in the Hebrew, the word means, sometimes you'd even get really into it and talk about the difference between the Greek version of dead and the Hebrew version. Then he'd ask us a compelling question, something like, when was the last time you felt dead? Huh? I asked myself. Honestly, who really needs to hear a definition of dead? And what difference did it make? I wanted to talk about how I could do a better job following Jesus, how to practice kindness, and what might be possible to do with my faith before I'm the Greek or Hebrew version of dead. This guy's intentions were totally pure, so I don't mean to trash him or anything. Plus, most of the things we studied at the Bible study were true and all, but honestly, it just made me feel like a stalker. Like a creepy guy memorizing facts and information about somebody I barely knew. Whatever it was that I needed, I wasn't finding it because I never wanted to do anything with what I learned. Most Wednesday nights, when I left the Bible study, I found I couldn't remember a single thing we talked about either. It was like somebody put a big magnet on my hard drive after the Bible study was over. Honestly, I wondered if there was something wrong with me. But then I realized the reason I didn't remember anything was because in the big scheme of things, it didn't seem that important to me. In other words, it didn't intersect my life. It just bounced up against my life on Wednesdays. What's up with equating Bible study with knowing God anyway? Wouldn't it be a horrible thing if we studied the ones we loved instead of bonding in deeper ways by doing things with them? I'd never want to get married to a girl no matter how much I studied her. I'd rather take her sailing or fishing or eat cotton candy with her on a Ferris wheel. I don't think knowing what her name means in the Greek is going to help me love her more. In fact, they have a name for guys who just study things about a person they like but don't do anything about it. They're called bachelors. So I started getting together with the same guys each week, and instead of calling it a Bible study, we call it a Bible doing. We've been at it for 15 years now, and I found there's a big difference between the two. At our Bible doing, we read what God has to say and then focus all of our attention on what we're going to do about it. Just agreeing isn't enough. I can't think of a single time when Jesus asked his friends to just agree with him. Sometimes the reason people try to memorize things is that they don't have another reference point from which to connect with a place or an idea or a concept. I get that. But the funny thing is, until I've experienced something personally, I usually can't remember it. You'd think that by hearing the same things many, many times, it would become part of us. But most of us just aren't wired to merely hear things and remember them. Not long ago, I listened to a Taylor Swift song called Love Story on a flight all the way from the East Coast to the West Coast. I had the song on repeat on my iPod for some reason, and as soon as it finished, it would automatically start once again. It's a happy song. Lots of banjo music at the beginning, as I recall. If you want to know how many times I heard that song, divide 3 minutes and 55 seconds by North America. Even though I heard the words sung over and over, you know what? I can't remember more than a few isolated lyrics. I remember that it's about a guy named Romeo, and I'm not quite sure who the girl is. I'm guessing it's Taylor. I think that they had to overcome some adversity because the girl's dad wasn't keen on young Romeo. As a dad, I can respect that. But at the end of the day, I can't remember how the song ends or whether the guy got the girl. I don't remember much about Taylor's love story, even though I've heard the song about 100 times. Why, in contrast, can we remember every nuance, every glance, and if we've fallen in love, our entire courtship story with such punishing detail? With our own love stories, every detail comes alive. Our own love stories are so poignant, so detailed, so unforgettable, at least to us. When it's someone else's love story, however, we will be polite and listen, but usually it's entirely forgettable. It's like looking at someone else's vacation pictures. When I have skin in the game, the outcome all of a sudden matters to me, and I become engaged. Some people think of engagement as the time between proposing marriage to someone and getting married. I think of engagement as the time between hearing a truth and nodding our heads in agreement and when we do something about it. That explains why Jesus never talked about us building consensus. He wanted us to build a kingdom instead. If you get engaged like that, you'll be able to remember Bible verses better because you're living them instead of just reading them. Another byproduct of engagement is all the canned answers we have to complex questions melt away. I think that's because we see ourselves in the context of something larger that is unfolding. The details aren't distractions. They're ladder rungs we can pull ourselves up on. We remember because we're no longer observers. I think Jesus had in mind that we would not just be believers, but participants. Not because it's hip, but because it's more accurate, more fitting that way. He wanted people who got to the do part, not just because he wanted activity, but because he wanted our faith to matter to us. One of the ways I make things matter to me is to move from merely learning about something to finding a way to engage it on my own terms. For example, if someone asks me what I think about capital punishment, instead of reciting the party line and parroting someone else's thoughts, I think of a teenager named Kevin in a prison in Uganda who had been accused of a capital crime. If the topic is same-sex attraction, I think of a dear friend of mine who is gay. Now, instead of talking about an issue, I'm talking about a person, someone who matters to me. I think that Jesus wired us that way so we'd remember. And it's not about being just politically correct, it's about being actually correct. We need to make our faith our very own love story. What I like about Jesus' message is that we don't need to just study him anymore to know him. That's what the religious people at the time were promoting. Collecting information about someone is not the same as knowing a person. Stalkers are ordinary people who study from afar the people they're too afraid to really know. Jesus said that unless you knew him like a child, you'd never really know him at all. Kids don't care about facts, and they certainly don't study each other. They're just with each other. They do stuff together. That's what Jesus had in mind. I listened to Taylor Swift's song a few more times since my trip across the country. This time I took notes so I'd remember how the story goes. It turns out that it all worked out great in the end for Taylor. Romeo stuck around even though his dad told him to split. She got a white dress, and according to Taylor, all she had to say was yes. But I bet Romeo didn't get to know her because he memorized her. I think it's because he did things with her. It's the same for us. Chapter 30. Palms Up. I used to think clenched fists would help me fight better, but now I know they make me weaker. I'm not a writer. I'm a lawyer. I think of myself as a recovering lawyer, actually. I sue companies that make crooked skyscrapers or bent buildings. I chose that kind of lawyering because I didn't want to defend a crook or somebody who kicked a dog or ran over his mother-in-law with a golf cart. Don't get me wrong. I'm no softy. I can be extremely confrontational when it comes to dirt and 2x4s. Some time ago, I stopped thinking about being a lawyer as a career. Instead, I just think of it as a day job. Thinking about work as a day job has made a big difference in the way I approach what I do. It's also helped me not to confuse who I am with what I do. I spend a great deal of time working for kids in Uganda and India and chasing bad guys who hurt them. I started a nonprofit a number of years ago, and now Sweet Maria and I think about my day job as a great way to fund the things we're doing. Now when I put on a suit and tie or jump on a plane to go take a deposition, we call it fundraising. It still makes me grin every time we say it this way. It's like a really successful bake sale to get rid of bad guys. Depositions are my favorite part of practicing law because they involve a lot of strategy. A deposition in a lawsuit is when the lawyer asks people lots of questions. Sometimes I even videotape the deposition, particularly if the person answering my questions has a short temper or a tendency to make things up. People who are like that can turn red and light up like a tomato. When they do, it makes for a great Kodak moment. Sometimes my clients have to be deposed, which means they're the ones being asked questions by the other guy's lawyer. It can feel intimidating with a big room full of lawyers all staring at you. So when my clients are being deposed, I tell them all the same thing each time. Sit in the chair and answer the questions, but do it with your hands, palms up, the whole time. I tell them to literally have the backs of their hands on their knees and their palms towards the bottom of the table. I'm very serious about this. In fact, I threaten to kick them in the shins if I look down and they don't have their palms up. When their palms are up, they have an easier time being calm, honest, and accurate. And this is important because it's harder for them to get defensive. When people get angry or defensive, they tend to make mistakes. But nobody can be defensive with their palms up. Go ahead, try it, right now, wherever you are. Set your hands on your knees and turn your palms towards the sky. You can try the opposite, too. Clench your fists. Most people could get angry at a grapefruit when their fists are clenched. Something about the hardwiring that God gave each of us linked the position of our bodies and the position of our hearts. I'm not sure why we're wired this way. I rarely have a client get frustrated or confused or tempted to exaggerate or tell a lie when his palms are up. I learned this technique actually from Jesus. I used to walk around with my fists clenched, defensive, afraid people were going to take advantage of me. There were also many evils in the world that caused me to clench my fists. I wanted to be angry and swing at the horrible things people do to one another, especially the things done to kids. But it was Jesus who taught me there was nothing I could really lose if I had him. He taught me to be palms up, just like he was. Palms up means you have nothing to hide and nothing to gain or lose. Palms up means you're strong enough to be vulnerable, even with your enemies, even when you've been tremendously wronged. Jesus was palms up to the end. When people ask me what it looks like to follow Jesus, I usually say that following him looks like dealing with all of the issues everyone else does. Disappointments, tremendous joy, uncertainty, the whole bit. And having your mind change all the time as you learn how Jesus would have dealt with things. Following Jesus is about having your paradigm shift as you navigate a wide range of emotions while living the big life Jesus invited us into. Because I know Jesus, where I once thought of things one way, now I think of them in another way. It happens all the time, every day. Jesus seemed to say that a lot himself. He would say, "You once thought this, but now I tell you it's different." And through the many paradigm shifts I've had following Jesus, the one that seems to universally apply is that we should all be palms up. Chapter 31. Two Bunk John. I used to think that taking a risk would reduce the number of friends I have, but now I know that love draws more people in. I've been teaching business law at a local university for over a decade. One year, there was a guy in the third row named John. He could have been a forward for the Lakers at 6'6" tall. He originally planned to be a doctor, then a biologist, but somehow ended up in the business school at the university and signed up for my class. Half the time I would be flying in from Seattle to San Diego to teach, so no one was allowed to be late to class. I figured if I could travel over 1,000 miles and get to class on time, my students could walk 100 yards and make it. John usually made it just by a hair. It was John's senior year, and he was trying to decide what he'd do after he graduated. One day, he invited me over to his house, where he and some other graduating seniors got together on Friday evenings with younger guys at the university to talk about how to live a different kind of life, one that wasn't typical. John was a bright and talented guy with an easy personality and a quick smile. He didn't love people the way Hallmark says to love people. He loved them linebacker style, in a full contact way. You wouldn't even know you'd been tackled by John's engaging love until you walked away, almost sore from it. I liked that these guys were talking about going off-road with their lives rather than arriving at safe places on a map, places that seem typical to them. I don't think anyone aims to be typical, really. Most people even vow to themselves sometime in high school or college not to be typical. But still, they just kind of loop back there somehow. Like the circular rails of a train at an amusement park, the scripts we know offer a brand of security, of predictability, of safety for us. But the problem is, they only take us where we've already been. They loop us back to places where everyone can easily go, not necessarily where we were made to go. Living a different kind of life takes some guts and grit and a new way of seeing things. John and his friends sounded like they wanted to take their faith off-roading a little. So when John invited me to come and be with his group, I told him I'd be there. Friday night came, and we had a big talk around a small fire. We talked about how we didn't need to operate on the same economy that everyone else did, how we didn't need to do things the way everyone else was doing them, and how we could aim for doing life together instead. We wouldn't need a flag or a banner or matching t-shirts or hoodies or even business cards. We could just do life like a pickup basketball game. If you've got a hook shot, you bring that. If you're not a good shooter, you pass the ball. What's distinctive about this way of doing life is that there are no scorekeepers or mascots. You just bring all the game you've got. Not surprisingly, the game you've got always seems to be enough. As the evening wound down, I stirred the coals of the fire a little and hoped I was stirring something inside each of these guys. I could tell I was for John. I told him there was no card trick involved. When you decide to drop everything that's typical, all that's left is just a big idea about an even bigger God, and a whole world that's worn out from the way everyone else has been doing it. The world has been shouting over the noise of our programs that it doesn't need more presidents or organizations. What it needs are more friends. If you're a sincere friend, folks around will quickly understand that there's no hidden agenda and nothing on the other side of the equal sign, just you. At the end of the evening, I finished by saying this, John, I dare you to spin the globe. Throw your finger down and pick a place to plug in. If you don't have another place to go, why not Uganda? The strategy we discussed was simple. We just go make friends and see what happened. Not the typical version of friendship, which is often called networking. Instead, we'd be real friends. John would tell me later that this all struck a chord inside of him. Not like a violin, more like a rock band. John was a guy who I could see didn't want to just think about an idea. He was ready to launch off the stage and go crowd surfing with it. Since we weren't angling to do things the way that they were usually done, there wasn't much to discuss either. Like the disciples, we had no plan, no program, and no preparation. I told John I had a whole fleet of airplanes to take him overseas. They all had Delta Airlines written on their sides, and for $1,500 he could get on one. A short time later, John ducked his head to clear the doorway of the 767 heading for Uganda. Just because we weren't going to plan everything didn't mean we weren't going to be strategic. It meant just the opposite. Instead of getting wrapped around the axle developing a plan, we used our time to develop a strategy, and we started in Uganda on purpose. It's a country which had been ravaged by a 20-plus year civil war, leaving millions of people displaced from their villages as virtual refugees in their own country. AIDS and other diseases had wiped out what the war didn't, and an entire generation of Ugandans were simply gone. The population in Uganda at the time had an average age of just over 14 and a half years old. Uganda had become a nation of children. When we first began doing our work in Uganda, 5 years before I met John, the country showed the signs of a nation at war with itself. Driving in northern Uganda in a small car like the one we had wasn't common. UN bulletproof vehicles were the norm. I envied the guys in the UN cars, not just because they looked manlier, but because you wouldn't die. Crossing the Nile River that divided the war-torn north from the south during the height of the insurgency, we came across checkpoints and roving military squads carrying machine guns every several miles. It was more than a little creepy. We quickly learned not to stop for anyone in camouflage, no matter how emphatically they waved. This is because the insurgents and the Ugandan military wore the same uniforms. We drove as fast as our small car would take us to Gulu, where there were military barracks nearby and a little more security. Although Gulu only covers 6 square blocks, It's the second largest city in the country because most of the population in Uganda lives in the bush. The entire country had suffered in the war, but Gulu and surrounding areas in the north had been hammered the worst by the Lord's Resistance Army, led by Joseph Kony, who launched attacks against northern Uganda. His strategy for growing his army was simple: abduct tens of thousands of children. The young boys were given machine guns and put out in front of the older soldiers in the firefights. The younger girls were forced to be child brides. Most of these children were 12 to 14 years old. What happened to them was unthinkable. When abducted, the children were often made to kill one or more family members in order to alienate them from the villages and shame them so they wouldn't try to return from the bush. Those who did try to escape were caught and killed in horrific manners as warnings to others. Just outside Gulu, we found thousands of kids living in camps set up by the government with no opportunity for an education at all. So we decided to start a school just north of the city. The local officials laid out for us at least 3 years of hoops to jump through before we could start. This seemed like lunacy to us, with an entire generation of kids living in camps without any schools at all, and the Lord's Resistance Army still conducting evening raids to abduct more children. We tried to reason with the government officials for a while about waiving the restrictions, and when it was apparent we weren't going to get their cooperation, we decided to open the school anyway. For the next month or two, we got word out as broadly as we could to the 500,000 displaced people in the region that we were starting a school. It would be called the Restore Leadership Academy. We let everyone know what a great idea the school was and braced for a huge turnout as a result of our efforts. On the first day of class, we had a total of 4 kids and 9 teachers show up. But we weren't discouraged at all. We were too busy chest bumping and high-fiving each other. We had a school. It wasn't Harvard. It was better. It belonged to 4 kids, 9 teachers, and us. John's task was to pull together the best Ugandan teachers from the north, assemble a student body, and start. We felt oversized and a little awkward with more teachers than students. Suspicions were high among the locals about the small school in the bush with a giant of a man named John running it. It wasn't long, however, before we had twice as many students. We were up to 8. This was explosive growth by our measuring stick. More students found their way to the classrooms, and by the end of the first year, we had 19. So we started a soccer team. Why not? We had more than enough players. The kids didn't have shoes, and the soccer field had a pole and a mango tree in the middle of it, but our kids never complained. Instead, they told us it gave them a home field advantage. Soon, there were 100 kids in the classrooms, which were now bulging, and the kids still kept coming. John called me with the great news about the school's growth and stories about students who once carried machine guns and navigated minefields, and who were now on our soccer field navigating a mango tree and a pole. John told me about 2 kids in particular who were walking 8 miles each day to attend class and what he thought they needed. It went something like this: Bob, would it be possible for us to give these 2 great kids a place to stay overnight at school? Absolutely not, John. We're not a boarding school, I responded immediately. John's thinking was kind and caring, of course, but I remembered that Oprah had started a school in South Africa and ran into a pack of trouble, and I resolved to never take on the responsibility of a boarding school. Besides, we could barely afford the school and the teachers, much less monitor, house, clothe, and start feeding boarding students. Sorry, John, no, I repeated. But Bob, come on, we just need 2 bunks. That's all, just 2 bunks, John insisted. No, John, I was on my feet, signing in the air with my left hand, and I was shaking my head vigorously. But it's for the kids, John pled. He was relentless. I could tell I wasn't going to win this round, and John did some Jedi thing, I supposed, as I heard myself saying, All right, John, 2 bunks for these 2 kids, but that's it, just 2 bunks. I promise were the last words he spoke to me about the bunk beds. It's now 3 years later, and at last count, we have over 250 boarding students at the Restore Academy. 2 Bunk John, as we call him now, spends most of his days conspiring with everyone he meets about ways to make these kids' lives richer, more meaningful, and more intentional. Do you know why all this happened? It's simple. 2 Bunk John got off the map. He wasn't limited by convention any longer. Instead, he leaked what he loved. He was leaking Jesus. And pretty soon, the puddle he made swallowed all of us by the lake it formed. That's the way the chemistry of God's love and our creativity work together when combined. No reservoir can hold it. No disappointment can stop it. No impediment contain it. It can't be waved off, put off, or shut down. It doesn't take no for an answer. Instead, it assumes yes is the answer, even when it sounds an awful lot like a no to everyone else. There's a national test given each year to high school students in the Republic of Uganda. It covers 13 subjects, including algebra, chemistry, physics, history, and geography, to name just a few. It's tougher than any test I've ever taken, and John and I wondered just how many of the original 19 students who'd grown up in the bush would pass it. Maybe one? Perhaps two? Some of these kids had been carrying machine guns or led families when their parents were lost to the war or died of AIDS. None of them had been in school. Honestly, in my mind, this national exam seemed like an insurmountable obstacle to these kids continuing with their education. What I had underestimated, though, was the resolve of Tubunk and the teachers at the academy. Shortly after the exams were graded by the national examiners, I got a call from John. "Bob, I'm holding the test results." There was a long pause. 19 for 19 passed. We all welled up with tears of joy and pride for what these kids had accomplished. That's one of the things about love. It doesn't recognize boundaries and never obeys the rules we try to give it. It seems that no one had told Tubunk or the teachers that they couldn't change the trajectory of the kids' educational futures, and that no one apparently told these kids they weren't supposed to pass the national exam. I guess no one told the Restore Academy soccer team that it was too small, too remote, too underfunded, or too barefoot when it came to playing soccer either. The next year, they beat every team in northern Uganda and boarded a bus heading to the capital to play for Uganda's national soccer title. And no one told one of the Restore girls she couldn't become Uganda's top-ranked javelin thrower. Because she did. I didn't even know we had a javelin. The following year, 30 more graduates would pass the national exam, as did the next 35 graduates the year after them. And no one told the entire student body at the Restore Academy when the test results came in this year that they couldn't get the highest test scores in all of northern Uganda, because they did. John and I met in the bush with the village elders last year, and we pointed together towards 40 acres of gently sloping African tundra that we had just purchased. We had outgrown the school and ran out of surrounding buildings to rent. It was time to build our own school. None of us thought, when we were sitting in John's backyard around a small fire 4 years earlier, that we'd be building an entire village-sized school for more than 300 teachers and students. We weren't thinking at the time about where the chain reaction would stop, and we're still not thinking about it. I'd like to think it's because we didn't have a plan. We had a big idea. The problem with my plans is that they usually work. And if they don't seem to be working, I force them to work, and I get the small results I aimed for. Swapping that for a big idea means I get everything that everyone brings to the pickup basketball game. Guys like John and the rest of the people who've joined us. Like Tubunk John, we're asking these kids to ignore what's typical too. We want them to be leaders through action, not just in name. Sponsorship programs are common in developing countries. For $30 or so each month, it's not unusual for a child to have a sponsor in the United States to help out with school fees. We got the kids together and explained to them how our sponsorship program was going to work. Our kids got some seeds, they plant the seeds, they raise the crops, they sell the crops, and with the money, our kids from the Restore Leadership Academy sponsor a little skater kid in Oregon with the Mentoring Project, an American organization that helps kids without dads. These Ugandan kids looked through the other end of the telescope and wanted to make sure that other kids can have the same input from mentors that they're getting. If these kids in the bush had a refrigerator, they would have a picture of a kid they were sponsoring in the U.S. on it. That's leadership. And the chain reaction continues to grow without people even knowing about it. I'll give you one last example. You probably didn't know when you bought this book that everyone, Thomas Nelson, me, my friend Don, everyone gave the money away to launch more kids into an atypical life. What that means is that you're part of this fantastic caper too. Because if I've learned one thing from Two Bunk John, it's that love does whatever it takes, and somehow everyone becomes part of it.
You've been listening to the audio production of Love Does. Text copyright 2012 by Bob Goff. Production copyright 2012 by Thomas Nelson. No portion of this recording may be reproduced without the prior written consent of Thomas Nelson Incorporated. For more information on other fine books and audio products from Thomas Nelson, please visit your favorite retailer or visit us online at thomasnelson.com. Love Does was recorded on location at Spotland Productions in Nashville, Tennessee.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.